I'm going to call the hearing to order, although we don't have a quorum yet, but we do have three important bills on the agenda for the day, and I know Representative Atkins probably has some other things he could be doing, so we're going to get started with Representative Atkins presenting his bill, and then when we get a quorum, we will move the bill. So, Representative Atkins, welcome to the committee, and we're going to be discussing House File 459.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I just realized when you said there's other things I could be doing, one of the things I thought I could be doing was perhaps having lunch. I didn't realize we had everything stacked up here in front of us. What I've said to folks, when it comes to BPA, which is bisphenol A, honestly, about 4 or 5 years ago when Representative Clark first came to me with the bill that dealt with it, I was pretty skeptical about the health impacts of BPA. I'm no longer skeptical. I've actually read most of the studies myself. I've kept up to date on it, and I am convinced, and I think most fair-minded, objective people are convinced, that BPA has a significant health impact, a negative detrimental health impact, particularly on the youngest, either in utero or toddlers, but children in particular. I've said that giving a kid BPA is somewhat akin to giving him a cigarette. And unfortunately, unwittingly, parents across Minnesota and all across the country do it without knowing that they're giving their child something that could be so potentially harmful to their health in the form of an endocrine disruptor. So a couple of years ago, Minnesota made some changes. We dealt with BPA in sippy cups and in baby bottles. And we're back because the scientific data continues to demonstrate that we've got the same threat as in baby jars or baby food jars. Literally in the cap is where you'll find the BPA. But there's also any number of products that are marketed specifically towards children, but also to Republican staff members. Are you listening? This is for you, Ken, for heaven's sake. Items that are specifically marketed towards children that contain BPA. And with that, Madam Chair, I can actually at this point talk about the science of BPA, but I happen to have somebody who's impeccably well-qualified and a heck of a lot more well-qualified than I am. Dr. Wallinga is going to join me here to talk about the science. And then I've got a parent who would like to visit with you about what's probably the most important element of the bill. So with that, I will turn it over to, is it Mr. or Dr. Wallinger? I figured it had to be doctor. But
yeah. Well, thank you, Representative Atkins. And I think that's a great idea, because even though this issue, or at least the other issues regarding BPA, have been around the legislature for a while, I don't know that everybody knows what it is or why we're concerned and that kind of thing. So I hope our testifier can help us there, and could I just, please state your name for the record, and I want to make sure that I get your name.
Sure. It's Dr. David Wallinga, and I'm a physician, Minnesota-trained, Roseville-born, and work at the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy. So I just want to give some background comments, both on the Toxic Free Kids Act, but also on the bisphenol A bill. And it's from sort of 16 years of working around the impact of the environment and products and chemical safety on kids. So we've got this really complex environment that kids are growing up in, and I've got an 11-year-old and a 7-year-old, so I think about this stuff with both hats on, too. And, parents are really sort of in a difficult situation because that environment, they often know a lot less about it than they probably would like to. There's been a huge amount of science that Representative Atkins referred to, but it's so voluminous that my 5 minutes or so, I can't give justice to it, so I just want to summarize kind of what's new about it. And it leads us to a place in thinking about children and their health and the environment that's kind of different than maybe what we were taught, in my case, 30 years ago or 25 years ago. So one thing is that most people realize that kids are just more vulnerable starting in utero because of their bodies are developing quickly. They do kind of funny things that bring them into exposure to products and pollutants that adults wouldn't have. Like they'll crawl around on the floor and, lick their hands or stick things in their mouths. And so anything that's in the dust or contaminating the floor environment, which is a lot of household products, they're going to get a bigger dose of. But the other thing that's important about kids is the, if you think about all their different organ systems, their brains, their hearts, their reproductive organs, they're all going through this kind of ballet of development. And certain things have to happen at a certain point in time in the first 13 years of life, and especially in that first 9 months in gestation. And if they don't happen in sequence, the ability of that kid, or even when they become an adult later in life, to do things normally or to for their organs to function normally is impaired. So we call these windows of susceptibility. And it seems from our science that certain organ systems are especially vulnerable to being disrupted. So we heard about hormone disruption, so the endocrine system, brain development. We have good data on things like lead and mercury, how that disrupts brain development if you get an early life exposure. But then heart and the immune system too. And these all leave kids really vulnerable. I try to put sort of the science studies down below my comments too. What's new though is the understanding that the mother's environment gets passed on to the fetus or to the child. But the fetus or child, they see the same pollutants that the mother does, but their exposures are much higher typically, especially on a weight-adjusted basis. So here's data from something called NHANES. This is a big national nutritional survey where they actually go out and collect blood and urine samples from thousands of Americans, including, in this case, pregnant women. And then they look for residues of chemicals in the blood or urine of those pregnant women. And you see the left-hand axis is the percent of women who have detectable levels of these chemicals. So the blue bars on the left are bisphenol A and phthalates, but then you have things like organophosphate pesticides, organochlorine pesticides, perfluorinated compounds like PFAS and PFOA, flame retardant chemicals like PVDEs, and PCBs and heavy metals, things like lead and mercury. So, you know, the take home here is not just that there's a lot of pretty colors, but that most women who are pregnant are exposed to multiple different chemicals in their environment, and then they're passing on that exposure to their fetuses and then to their kids. And many of these same chemicals, and even more, are also routine contaminants in breast milk. Okay, so mom's passing things through the womb, but then they continue to pass these environmental chemicals to the baby after they're born. So the last piece that's kind of new is that these environmental exposures of mom interact with the young child's susceptibility, and they can cause disease not only in the young child, but across that child's whole lifespan. So early exposures causing lifelong disease. And that's kind of the thing to wrap your head around. That's what's new. And it means that if we can prevent exposures early in life, then we can head off the contributions to later in life disease. That's a really good investment on a dollars and cents basis. So again, there's thousands of studies now linking these early child environments to different diseases. I've just listed a few. There are links between early exposures to brain toxins and later in life deficits in IQ, learning, and behavioral problems. There's links between exposure to things like DES and later in life vaginal cancer and other reproductive cancers. There's links between early environments in utero and later in life cardiovascular disease, and I can go on and on. Obesity, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, etc., infertility. So bisphenol A, just to use an example, and a really relevant one to us, is interesting because it's a synthetic hormone. It's estrogen-like. You can see in the structure here with these two benzene rings, it looks a lot like DES. And DES was taken off the market in the mid-1970s. But bisphenol A is very much like that. And we heard that it's in a lot of products, including food containers like can linings and baby food jars. it's not the only chemical. It's one among several, but it's one that's of particular concern. There's a lot of other products that bisphenol A is used in, too. 6 billion pounds produced per year. And basically, we're all exposed to it. The CDC sampling finds 93% of the American public has detectable levels. Generally, the levels are higher in babies than adults, higher in females, too. Babies' levels could be 11 times higher than adults on a weight-adjusted basis. So just to finish up, so if you look in totality, there's more than 700 studies now, independent studies, animal studies, laboratory studies, finding adverse effects of many different kinds associated with low-level exposure to bisphenol A. And these exposures, the exposures that we currently have, are hundreds of times higher than what the EPA considers to be a safe level of exposure. So the effects, you have to realize, are not just one thing. The effects that are being linked to bisphenol A are across a number of organ systems. So cancers, problems with behavior, reproduction, you know, just many different organ systems. Now, there are human studies, too. 20 different studies in people linking higher levels of bisphenol A in the urine with things like heart disease, diabetes, obesity, behavior change, lower quality of semen, recurring miscarriages. We don't have more of these human studies because if you have a chemical that looks very, very close to DES, ethically you wouldn't want to prospectively dose a population of women with that chemical. So you're often relying on animal studies more than the human studies. Nope. And with that, I'm just going to stop and move back to...
Okay. Well, with that, we do have a quorum now, so we can officially call the meeting to order. And do we have a motion to move the minutes of February 20th? Anybody?
Madam Chair.
All right.
I move we accept the minutes for February 20th.
All right. Representative Ward moves to approve the minutes of February 20th. Any discussion? All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed, no. And minutes are approved. And then, Representative Atkins, I'm going to move your bill, House File 459. And where are we going with this? And that it be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Judiciary Committee. Is that your understanding?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Okay. So, and then, is this... there's an amendment in the packet. Is that your amendment, Representative?
Madam Chair, we're not. That is my amendment. We're not prepared to offer it at this time.
Okay.
We'll likely do it in
all
the
right.
committee.
Very good. So, okay. So, having gotten all of that out of the way, please proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And with that, I'd introduce Ms. Diana Spurgeon. I believe that she may be Representative Mack's constituent. She's a parent from Apple Valley, I believe. Is that right?
Yeah.
And with that,
okay.
Ms. Spurgeon.
Welcome to the committee, and just please give us your name for the tape and proceed. Yeah.
My name is Diana Spurgeon. Just go ahead. Okay. I live in Apple Valley with my husband, my 4-year-old daughter Lily, and my 2-year-old son Quinn. I've been an Apple Valley resident now for 8 years. And for me, the desire to do the best that I can for my children began when I was pregnant with my first child. I was very careful to follow all the recommendations of my doctor. I ate a healthy diet. And I read all the popular books for expectant mothers. Informed and determined, I thought I was going above and beyond in providing the safest, healthiest environment for my child. Then one day at a breastfeeding class, a fellow classmate asked, "What about BPA?" BP what? I thought to myself. I had never heard of this chemical. So I immediately investigated all my breastfeeding equipment and found that luckily it was all BPA-free. However, I learned that the other feeding and teething items that I already had were not. How could this be? I had lived under the assumption that the regulatory systems in our state and nation protected children against harmful chemicals. That day was an awakening for me and one that would change my life. Prior to that day, shopping was but a side activity in my preparation for motherhood. After that day, I was plagued with the burden I'm trying to educate myself on chemical safety, exhaustively research children's products, and expend significant time and money purchasing specialty products that were not readily available at that time. Shopping for the simplest of baby items became a daunting and time-consuming task. Fortunately, I had taken that breastfeeding class and became informed on BPA, as well as several other harmful chemicals, before my daughter was actually born. So there was still time to discard the items I had purchased or that were given to me as baby shower gifts. Phew, I had dodged a huge bullet just in time. Or at least that's what I thought. Although I had become quite informed about the toxic effects of chemicals such as BPA, phthalates, formaldehyde, and others, I still had no idea just how prevalent they were in everyday products. Only after my children had consumed countless jars of baby food, containers of formula, cans of organic beans and soup, which I thought were healthy for them, did I learn about the presence of BPA in these products. I was devastated when I learned about this. Again, how could this have happened when I was so diligent and so informed? My experience illustrates that no parent can be 100% informed on chemical safety or the chemical composition of every product that they buy. This is why we must be able to rely on our lawmakers to enact legislation to protect families. In 2009, Minnesota became the first state to ban BPA in baby bottles and sippy cups, and in doing so lifted a huge burden on parents. I was so grateful that when my son was born in 2010, I no longer had to spend $12 or drive across town just to find a BPA-free bottle. However, more work needs to be done, and it is important to act now. I do not yet know what the effect the chemicals my children were exposed to at the most vulnerable times in their lives will be. I only wish that legislation had been in place 5 years ago so that I would not have to wonder. This is why I support the Toxic Free Kids Act, as well as other legislation to reduce the use of BPA and formaldehyde-releasing chemicals. Thank you for your time today.
All right. Thank you very much. And could you just spell your name for us, please?
Yep. Last name is Spurgeon, S-P-U-R-G-E-O-N.
All right. Thank you very much, Ms. Spurgeon. Okay. Are there any other testifiers on the bill? I think we do have some others. And I'm not seeing any questions here. Do members have questions, well, of these testifiers before we go to the next group? Okay, I'm not seeing any, so. Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Tony Quillis. I'm the Director of Environmental Policy at the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, and I'm going to apologize outright. I'm going to give you the same preamble for all three bills that I'm going to be up testifying on, that the Chamber of Commerce, number one, Madam Chair, thinks that chemical regulation in this nation should be done at the federal level. It's very confusing for our members to go through, and if you will, a chemical de jure, to do it chemical by chemical, state by state. In the chain of commerce, it makes it confusing, Madam Chair. So I just want to get that out of the way so that, you'll hear that again on the next two, but I just wanted to let you be aware of that. The chemical we're talking about right now, bisphenol A or BPA, I would argue is probably, and Dr. Goodman can elaborate on it, one of the most heavily tested chemicals in the world. And Representative Atkins had referenced a couple of studies, and I'd like to reference a couple also in your packet. There is one from the FDA on the bottom, is dated March 2012. That states that BPA through foods for infants is much less than had previously believed, and that trace amounts of the chemical that enter the body, whether it's an adult or child, are rapidly metabolized and eliminated. And that's on the bottom of that middle column, right underneath the can and the bottle picture there. The other one that I'd like to reference very quickly is Health Canada. As you'll see, it's dated September of 2012. And on that last page under conclusion and recommendations, if you'll bear with me, just the last two sentences that say, therefore, based on the overall weight of evidence, the findings of previous assessments remain unchanged, and Health Canada's food directorate continues to conclude that current dietary exposure to BPA through food packaging uses is not expected to pose a health risk to the general population, including newborns, and young children. This conclusion is consistent with those of other food regulatory agencies in other countries, including the United States, the European Union, and Canada. Madam Chair, what we're talking about, as Representative Atkins has helped me out by putting these cans in front of us, is an epoxy that goes on the inside of cans that prevents infection from being in there. When we talk about foodborne illnesses, and you read about those in the paper, you'll never hear them from inside of the cans. You'll hear them from a restaurant or where hands are touching it, but not from inside of cans. And one of that reasons, it's a food safety issue, is to protect the contents on the inside of those cans. You know, we've been working on trying to go through and do it, and there's just different compositions. As it's been pointed out, we were the first state in the nation to take it out of sippy cups and baby bottles. That's a different composition of BPA. And we're talking about now is a kind of an epoxy resin, and Dr. Goodman can talk about this much more than I can. But we've been able to go through and take it out of sippy cups and baby bottles. We've been going through, we've taken it out, have shown that we could take it out of plastic to go through for infant formula cans. We've gone through, we can do it for glass. What the industry's having a hard time trying to do is get it out of cans. They're different sizes. I walked through a local retailer the other night on my way home. There was three rows of cans just in the food section of the retailer. And if you went through there, there's just different sizes, if you will, a tuna can, some of a smaller oyster can. There's soup cans. There's bean cans. Each of those cans is different. And the content of each of those cans all has to be tested. And the only way to test it is to go through and check a replacement chemical and then set it on the shelf and to go through and make sure sometimes as much as I complain about my job here, my job at least isn't opening up those cans after 2 or 3 years and going, whoa, how come those green beans are blue or what's that smell in there? We'd better go to plan B. So if we go through and look at those, that's why some of them we've worked. Corn works. Green beans don't. Some tomato paste works. I'm trying to think of, and Dr. Goodman can go through. So we found it on some instances, but we can't on everything, and we're trying, the industry's trying, but we can't go through to do that. And one last thing before I turn it over to Representative or Dr. Goodman, Madam Chair, to keep in mind in your deliberations that there are 5 can manufacturers in the state of Minnesota. There's 741 jobs. The jobs average a little bit over $55 or $55,000 a year. $1.5 billion economic activity in this state, and $56 million in state taxes just from those 5 facilities in this state. So, Madam Chair, I thank you for your time, and I'd like to turn it over to Dr. Goodman.
Yeah, thank you for your testimony. And I guess I just have one really quick question based on your testimony. If I was understanding you right, you're saying this cannot be taken out of cans of certain kinds of foods just yet because apparently the replacements aren't there to be able to achieve the same results. Is that kind of what I'm understanding from you?
Like I said, I'm going to let Dr. Goodman elaborate on it. There are certain products in certain cans that it can be done on. But Representative Atkins' bill prohibits all cans and all products targeted to children under 12. So essentially, you would ban Campbell's soup in the state of Minnesota.
Well, that was kind of where I was going. So are you saying that if we were to pass this bill and it was to become law, that there are certain products, and I'm not talking about a brand, but certain kinds of foodstuffs that simply could not be sold to children because they cannot be put in containers that are free of BPA? Is that basically what you're saying?
Yeah, there are certain foods.
Oh, okay, wait. Now, okay, we need to get your name on the tape. And why don't you go ahead, and you'll probably answer my question in the course of your testimony. Just give us your name, please.
Okay, thank you. I'm Dr. Julie Goodman. I'm an epidemiologist and board-certified toxicologist at Gradient, which is an environmental consulting firm. I also teach at the Harvard School of Public Health, and I'm also a mom. I have been working on BPA for about 8 years now, and I'm here today representing the Can Manufacturers Institute. HF 459 will prohibit the sale of children's food containers containing BPA. BPA in food packaging is not harmful, so this bill will not provide any public health benefit and may result in harm. Now, there have been thousands of studies that have been conducted on BPA in humans, laboratory animals, and in other laboratory settings. And leading regulatory bodies around the world, as you just heard, like EPA, FDA, Health Canada, European Food Safety Authority, have all evaluated these studies. And if you have my testimony in front of you, I've listed several of these in Table 1. But basically, they've all concluded that, I have a quote from FDA because it sums it up nicely, "The scientific evidence at this time does not suggest that the very low levels of human exposure to BPA through the diet are unsafe." And there are really two reasons for this. The first is that BPA is not toxic in laboratory animals unless they're exposed to extremely, extremely high doses. And second, humans are exposed to BPA at levels thousands and thousands of times lower than this. And so I wanted to put this in perspective. So what I did is I said, how many servings of canned foods would a 15-kilogram child, so that's about 30 pounds, a two-year-old, or a 70-kilogram adult, that's about a 150-pound adult, would have to eat to exceed the safe level of animals? And I show this in Table 2 in my testimony. So, for example, a child would have to have 214,286 cans of tuna a day. An adult would have to have 1 million cans a day to exceed the safe level in animals. And even if you took a food that has a higher level of BPA, like there's some chicken soups, a child would have to have 527 servings a day. Clearly, this is beyond the realm of possibility. And, you know, of course, studies continue. There are ongoing studies that are being funded by or are actually being conducted at EPA and FDA. And these are specifically designed to address the controversy. For example, you heard that small children are more susceptible than adults. Well, these studies look to see is the fetus, what's the exposure to a fetus after a mother's ingested BPA, and they actually found little to no BPA at all. They found that newborns are able to metabolize BPA just like adults. There have also been many studies specifically designed. Others have claimed on one side of the controversy that there's methodological deficiencies in studies, and this is why some studies are showing a lack of effects. And they've given reasons like the wrong rat strain is used, the wrong doses. Essentially, what FDA has done is they've taken all these issues and said, okay, you said we used the wrong rats, we're going to use the rats you're telling us to use. You said we didn't use the right doses, we'll use the doses you say. And study after study, they're still confirming the results they found before. And that's a lack of effect of BPA at low exposures. And by low exposures, these are still, you know, 1,000 times higher than human exposures. And I just wanted to bring up, last week in the Wall Street Journal, there was an article summarizing a study by Justin Teagarden. He works at the Department of Energy in Tacoma, Washington. He reviewed studies of 30,000 people in 19 countries, including women and infants, and basically found, as I've been saying, human blood levels of BPA are thousands of times lower than the levels you see in animals and that cause biological effects. So to close, prohibiting the sale of children's food containers containing BPA will not result in any public health benefit and may have the unintended consequence of limiting food choices in Minnesota. And if you look at the weight of scientific evidence, it does not support HF 459. And just before I finish, I want to mention that these comments are about the safety of BPA, and they pertain also to HF 605. So rather than just repeat my testimony later, I'm happy to answer questions now or be available for questions when you discuss that bill later today. So thank you for your time.
Okay. Well, thank you, Dr. Goodman. And maybe you could just address my question, and then I have another member with a question, but I don't think you answered my question. So if we were to pass this bill, I mean, given what was said before, that certain products cannot be packaged safely without BPA, would there be certain foodstuffs that simply could not be sold in Minnesota if we were going to pass this bill because it's impossible to get BPA out of those containers?
Yeah, so there are some alternatives that are available for some foods, but for some foods there are no alternatives. So that means that those foods could not be sold in cans in Minnesota.
Okay, could you be more specific? Which foods would we expect to not have sold if this bill becomes law?
I actually don't know that offhand, but if it's something you'd like me to look into, I'm happy to do so and get you that information.
Well, maybe between the two of you, I mean, it was said before that certain foods needed to have this kind of packaging in order to be safe. So are you, I don't know, maybe I've forgotten your name.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the industry is working to try and get the chemical out of the cans. They're trying very hard. They have done it on certain foodstuffs. Like I said, tomato paste appears to be okay, and we can get that out. Corn appears to be okay. Green beans, they haven't found the solution yet. Soup, we haven't found the solution yet. They're working on it. I promise you they are. But we haven't been able to do that right now.
Okay. Well, thank you. And one follow-up to that. Dr. Goodman just went through a long litany of how safe this stuff is. So that being the case, why is the industry working so hard to find alternatives?
Madam Chair, and some of that is consumer demand. I mean, we're always trying to go through and find alternatives. We could go back, and I agree with Dr. Goodman, that if you go through the FDA, Healthy Canada, or Health Canada, can go through and do that. But we're always trying to find alternatives and trying to modernize and update our products, and we're trying to find to go through and do that, but we haven't been able to do it in all products. So, Madam Chair.
Okay. Representative Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Goodman, I see this item from the Consumer Health Information FDA. It says it continues to study BPA. If you read the article, it seems that the Food and Drug Administration has pretty much concluded that BPA isn't a problem. So my question to you is, why does it continue to study the problem if there isn't one?
So that was to Mr. To Dr. Goodman, sorry.
Well, as I said, I mean, there continues to be controversy, and it continues to be in the news, and people are worried about it. And so the idea is that I think what FDA is doing is right. They're saying, people are saying that there could be issues, and here's why. So they're basically directly addressing those issues head on.
Mr. Fall.
Representative Benson.
So is it your position that the persons who are bringing these concerns are doing so without any basis in fact?
Dr. Goodman.
I think there's, as I said, there's been thousands of studies, and I would say, you know, a few years ago when I came to Minnesota, that the evidence was solid that BPA was safe. But people, I mean, for example, I did not think there was an issue with the rat strains that were used. Other people thought there could be. So I don't see anything wrong with addressing that if that's what people are concerned about, and that's what FDA has done. And as I said, they find there's still no problem.
Representative Benson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, you know, it probably isn't proper for me to ask you to surmise, but the suggestion seems to be that the FDA is carrying on these investigations simply to resolve a political problem. Is that the industry's view?
Dr. Goodman.
Yeah, I don't. So, although, as I said, I'm here on behalf of the Can Manufacturers Institute, I mean, they've hired me as an independent scientist, and it's just my job to evaluate the data, and I basically included information from other agencies around the world to show this isn't just my opinion, it's also that of these other agencies. So I don't really feel like I'm in a position to speak for industry on that point.
Just very quick.
Representative Benson.
Thank you for your indulgence. It's my understanding that in the European Union, industry does not introduce new chemical compounds until they have been proven to be safe. Not by the industry, but by agencies in those societies. Do you think that would be a wise move for the United States, instead of leaving this to industries who have a financial interest in introducing these compounds, that it should be done by an independent scientific investigation?
Dr. Goodman.
I think what's most important is that the methods that are used are transparent, and that everybody has access to the data. So whether it's conducted at industry, by government, by somebody independent, that everybody can see the data and evaluate it. So that way, because the issue isn't really in the studies themselves, it's in the interpretation of the studies. So if all stakeholders have access to the data, then we can have an honest conversation about it and really get to the bottom of what's safe.
Okay. Representative Lohmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for your testimony, Dr. Goodman. It was really interesting. Just the idea that there's no adverse health effects, I'm thinking about that as I think of this question, and also Representative Liebling is talking about food sold. But what about food shelves? Would food shelves, if these foods were out there, be liable for providing, you know, canned goods that had some adverse, well, they're not adverse, but having these BPAs? And what would we stock our food shelves with, I guess, is kind of my question.
I'm sorry, I don't
right.
quite understand the question.
Just so I could frame, remember the bill only deals with children's products, but go ahead, Dr. Goodman.
But don't we stock food shelves with children's products?
Oh, yeah. But
I mean, any children don't buy food, right. We do, and adults supply them. So I guess I'm just curious about how it would affect food shelves. And
so are you saying how would it affect the foods that we buy?
Yeah, there would be foods that we could not either put into food shelves, or there might be some liability if these foods that had these.
Dr. Goodman.
Am I not making sense?
I mean, I guess I'm not following. I'm not quite sure. Are you asking? It's yes, foods that where there isn't an alternative to BPA for the lining, they couldn't be put in cans, so those foods wouldn't be available. Is that the question you're asking?
Representative Ulmer.
I'm not sure what.
Okay. Representative Ulmer, maybe we could ask Representative Atkins that question.
Okay, that's
and if
that
we can finish.
Good.
We have other members on the list, and yeah. Maybe when we get through with these, we can go back to Representative Atkins. Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks for your testimony. I got two questions. The first one is to Mr. Kowalas. Is that correct? Okay. Good thing I had phonics in school. So basically, if I understand you correctly, if we pass this bill, you wouldn't be able to sell certain items in cans that have not developed the ability to stay eatable until because you don't have a substitute for BPA. Is that correct?
Mr. Quillis?
Madam Chair, Representative Grunhagen, that is correct. In the bill, it says no manufacturer or wholesaler may sell in this state as of January 2014, and no retailer may sell as of January 2015 anything that has BPA in it and container. So, in other words, any box, jar, can, including a lid, would not be able to be sold in this state.
Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, that was my understanding. I just want a clarification from your perspective also. Thank you, Madam Chair. The next question I have is actually for the good doctor who testified for Representative Atkins' bill.
Okay. Yeah, you could come back. Welcome back, Dr. Wallinga.
Thank you.
Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Wallinga?
Wallinga. Yeah.
Wallinga. Okay, yeah. Your name's not on your handout here, so I was at least I didn't see it. Anyway, you know, I'm a layperson, and obviously this is a high degree of expertise that we're talking about in terms of these chemicals, their effect, and nobody wants to see children, unborn or born, receive damage from some type of ingestion of chemicals. So my initial reaction is, you know, sounds like a good idea to get rid of this. But when I look at the other testimony from Dr. Goodman and some of the research that has come in on that area, especially with the FDA, and the reason the FDA, which I don't have a high opinion of in a number of areas, but in terms of the scientific experiments that they do, they have the resources, because obviously this is an extremely expensive, the way I understand, correct me if I'm wrong, process to do the necessary testing in a repeatable, observable way under certain conditions to come to conclusions that apply to the food industry. And I don't see us at the state level being able to duplicate those types of resources or those types of experiments that they have at the federal level. So the FDA statements that I've seen here, and you've heard too and probably read, seem to carry a lot of weight with me in terms of whether to support this bill. And I'm concerned also that if it doesn't have the negative effects that has been proposed, at the levels that it's at, that we're simply going to drive up the cost and limit the choices for our families here in the state of Minnesota. So I appreciate your response to Dr. Goodman's testimony, and especially the part about the FDA conclusions.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, as I understand it, oh, I'm sorry. As I understand it, there are many, many studies finding adverse effects from exposure to bisphenol A. I think Dr. Goodman was extrapolating a little bit and saying that the FDA concluded that those adverse effects were not relevant to people. I have a little different perspective. It's very important who does the studies and who funds the studies, and that when a review, typically when the FDA looks at the state of the science, they don't actually go out and do new science. They scan the kind of the whole scientific literature they're supposed to, and then draw a conclusion. The problem is that when the FDA did its review, it ignored hundreds of independent scientific studies, and it based its conclusions on a much smaller set. When a different federal program, the National Institutes of Health National Toxicology Program, instead reviewed 700 different studies, they expressed concern that exposure to BPA was having effects on brain behavior and prostate glands in fetuses, infants, and children, and that those effects were occurring at current levels of exposure in people. Similarly, other agencies and convenings have done similar reviews. So, for example, the Chapel Hill consensus statement was 38 experts convened who looked at the state of the evidence on bisphenol A. These were some of the leading researchers on the chemical, and they determined that BPA exposure causes harm to human health at low doses when that exposure occurs in utero or early in life. So I think, in summary, that when you look at a broader range of studies, including independent studies, not the industry finance studies, you might draw a different conclusion. The FDA, let's not get confused, the FDA has sort of determined that it's safe. That doesn't mean that the studies haven't found effects. They've just determined that those effects are not worth worrying about. But again, you've heard from many folks that have reached a different conclusion. And finally, I just want to ask, apparently Japan has phased out bisphenol A in can linings over 10 years ago and meets current food safety standards. So I'm just curious, it seems like there are alternatives being used in other countries as well as here by Eden Foods and others. And so clearly, Japan's either more innovative than U.S. can manufacturers, or they know something we don't, I guess.
Representative Mack. Finished, Representative Grunhagen, I'm
sorry.
Yeah,
just a quick follow-up. I guess I would suggest to the author that he work with the can industry. I think if you narrow the bill some to address the areas where there is a substitute versus where there isn't, especially based on the fact that we have conflicting scientific opinions as far as the actual results, I think that might make the bill more... I mean, it's so sweeping to me. I think it's a little overkill. It's just the conclusion I'm coming to. But anyway, with that, I'll close.
Thank you. Representative Mack.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a couple of questions for the author. Do you know, does it disclose on any can right now or any product if there's levels of BPA used in the packaging?
That to Dr. Willinga?
I guess either one, the author or Dr. Willinga. I'm just wondering if there's disclosure on a product, if there's any BPA used.
Madam Chair, Representative Mack, I'm not aware of, in fact, I'm looking at some products in front of me that do not disclose that they've got BPA in the product. I'm not certain, though, that applies to, there may be some that disclose it. I wouldn't want to speak for all of them.
Representative Mack?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then to the bill, I'm just looking at the section where it defines children's food on 1.14 through 1.16, and I guess my first question is, why the age 12? How is that age picked in terms of the criteria for who this can and cannot be sold to or marketed towards?
Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Mack. I actually might look to Dr. Wallinger to, because there is, you know, it's a matter of determining at what age would be the defining point, and I suspect that he might have a little better data for you.
Dr. Wallinger.
Or if he doesn't, I suspect someone here would.
I think my colleague Kathleen Chu is saying the Toxic Free Kids Act has age 12. I would say biologically speaking, these organ systems that I talked about that are developing that leave children at a higher risk continue to develop, especially pre-adolescence, but even through adolescence. So if you think of age 12, it's sort of right in that beginning of adolescence point.
Representative Mack.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just one last question on the same issue. And, of course, with the interest of keeping kids safe and unborn safe and everything else, I guess my question is on those same lines, 1.14 to 1.16. It just seems poorly crafted in the sense that I don't understand how where the parameters are for a business or a company to understand if their market or if their product is going to someone under 12 or above 12, you know, SpaghettiOs. I know a lot of 5-year-olds that eat SpaghettiOs. I know a lot of 15 and 25-year-olds that eat SpaghettiOs. How is a company to know if their product is geared specifically towards a 12-year-old? If they simply change their packaging, take the cartoon off, then is it fine? That just seems wide open for a lot of confusion in the market, confusion by consumers to understand what is and is not marketed towards a 12-year-old and what 12 and under people eat versus those older. There seems to be a lot of crossover.
Representative Atkins.
Madam Chair, thank you, Representative Mack. I appreciate that insight and that input. I suspect that most of the manufacturers know who their target audience is, and it's a little, when you look at it, it doesn't take long to figure out who this might be targeted at, but to the extent that we can wrap language around that would clarify that a little bit further, that would be helpful.
Thank you,
Representative Mack.
One last comment to that. I appreciate that. I think some clarification would be helpful, and even probably for your purposes, if this continues to move forward as is, if they know who their marketed audience is, but they don't want to have to comply with this law, they can be crafty in their marketing. And so I think some specifications would probably serve both purposes well, just to bring some clarity there, because at this point, it seems like it would be very vague and confusing. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Right. Thank you, Representative Mack. And just to let members know, at some point this will be going to the Commerce Committee. So this is definitely not the last stop for this bill. Okay, members, I have, just to tell you, I have Representative Albright, Franzen, Allen, Zerwas, and Lohmer. And we do have two other bills that are quite closely related in some ways. So Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This would be to the testifier. You mentioned in your testimony that the EPA didn't look at the data in what you would deem to be inappropriate, or they excluded numerous studies that would have had more credible evidence to the contrary of the findings. But yet, in light of that testimony, we have such organizations such as the countries of Australia, New Zealand, Japan, European Food Safety Authority, Health Canada, World Health Organization, the United Nations, BPA Review, the California Development and Reproductive Toxicant Identification Committee, and the General Federal Institute for Risk Assessment. So my first question is, if we are not to believe the EPA and these other organizations are coming to a similar conclusion, are they all wrong?
Representative Atkins, or
Madam Chair, if I think it's to Dr. Wallinger, and I want to give him a chance to answer. I just wanted to make sure, for the point of clarity, that the BPA or BPA has been banned by the FDA for baby bottles and sippy cups. I think there was some confusion, but as of 7 months ago, the FDA, not the EPA, which I assume you were referencing, mm-hmm. the FDA, did in fact ban BPA from baby bottles and sippy cups after 11 other states had already banned it in the sale of products. With that, though, I want Dr.
Well,
Wallen
then,
to
in
okay, Representative
Madam Chair,
Albright.
In light of that, Representative Atkins, then I'll move to the bill on 2.20, where it suggests baby products, toys, car seats, personal care products, and clothing. But I thought in the testimony that thus far that I've listened to, it relates only to points where BPA is ingested. How would this relate to a banning of BPA in those products?
Representative Albright, where are you?
Am I on the wrong bill?
We turned our bill over, but we couldn't find that line.
Are you suggesting an amendment, Representative Albright?
I'd like a delete all on this one. I apologize to the committee.
Representative Albright, how about if we go to Representative Franson and then we'll come back to
Thank you?
All right, Representative Franson.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I am a author on this bill, and I'm going to continue hopefully working with the author on this, but, well, I haven't worked with you yet, but hearing from the
Well, let's start now.
But I do have a lot of concerns. You know, this is very sweeping. I mean, I'm not a fan of chemicals. I don't use chemicals in my home. I just try to stay away as much as possible. What was very interesting is when, being the mother of the year that I am, my children had some fillings. And can you imagine that there's two types to choose from? I have the type that have mercury, and I have the type that have BPA to choose from. And as a mom, I'm trying to make educated choices on what it is that I actually want to take care of my children's teeth with. So that was very heart-wrenching. Do I put mercury in my children's mouth, or do I put BPA? And I ended up putting the white fillings, which have the BPA in it, and because I thought maybe that was the lesser of the two evils. But I still, you know, hopefully that down the road there's not some health adverse effects that come back and say it's because of the fillings that I chose to put in my child's mouth. While it does sound like a good idea, and could you just repeat, why is it that Japan is able, or maybe it's not you, sir, but somebody can say that Japan is able to put safer products in their cans, whereas we're not able to. I mean, I would hate to have to ban SpaghettiOs from our children, because I still feed my kids SpaghettiOs, because I'm a really great cook. I'm a terrible cook. But anyway, could you just explain that, why what it is that's holding that up, or maybe we just can't do it at all? Is it the acidity of the tomatoes, or...
Madam Chair, while we're getting assistance, I did want to point out that Campbell's is actually in the process of phasing out BPA in their canned goods. But Dr. Wellinger can perhaps talk about the Japan experience and why they've done it and how they've been able to...
I don't have specifics on how they did it, but, you know, knowing some history of similar sort of regulatory processes, I would say that experience seems to suggest that industry can be very innovative, but they also need to be incented to innovate. And perhaps Japan was very clear in the goal that they were moving towards, and the industry responded by finding alternatives to the can liners.
All right. I've got Representative Albright. Are you ready to go now?
Yes, I have a question with regard to House File 459. For the author of the bill, Representative Atkins.
Yes, sir.
My understanding in doing some research on this topic is that this BPA sealant is also used commercially in water towers. Is that true?
I'm sorry, in what?
Water towers, municipal water towers.
Representative Atkins.
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, I'm not aware of it, and I'm not, all right. But go on.
Just,
Representative Albright.
For the sake of argument, with the line of thinking on this, then, if that were true, and if municipalities were selling water to the residents, would it not be true that they would be prohibited from doing that if it were on the inside of water towers and they were drinking the water?
Representative Atkins.
Madam Chair, a couple of things. Number one, I'm not aware that they're doing that. Number two, I'm not aware that the water is exposed to the BPA. And number three, I'm not aware that the bill would necessarily apply because it's not being marketed specifically towards children. But I will take a look into it and see what I can find out.
That's on House Foil 459.
All right.
459.
Thank you, Representative Albright, for your question on 459. Representative Allen, do you have a question on 459?
I'm sure what that is. I think, Dr. Walling, you answered my question about the it said that the FDA didn't say conclude that it was not harmful. They're just, they have concern, but that the test, I mean, it's difficult with those tests, like things like rates of absorption in the body or the method that it's delivered. But it really, I mean, would you say that this is, at this point, the justification would be is enough that it is about prevention and that because of the harm it could potentially cause our children, that and that there is enough studies that raises enough concern that we should act to prevent and so for the safety of our children?
Dr. Wallinga.
Yes, Madam Chair, thank you. I would say that the reasoning goes something like this. This is a synthetic estrogen, okay, much like DES, which we know causes cancer. Americans are almost universally exposed, and we know some of the routes of that exposure, but probably not all of them. And the levels of exposure seem very relevant to the levels found to cause harm in hundreds of studies. And then three, that in many cases, like with baby bottles, there are alternatives, and it's not necessary. And so you combine all those things, and yes, part of the rationale is we may not know every single answer to every single question we can imagine, but we know enough, and we know how to prevent exposure to it, so that seems like a pretty prudent public health thing to do.
Okay, Representative Zerwas.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. On House File 459.
Thank you.
I have a couple questions for Dr. Wallinga. I apologize for being out at the very beginning when you first started, so I didn't get your background, educational background, your background with BPA or these types of chemicals.
Right.
So if you could indulge me with that.
Dr. Wallinga.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, growing up in Roseville, went to medical school at the University of Minnesota, got a public affairs degree from Princeton University, spent the last 16 years looking at the science around children and their environment, how that environment impacts on their development and health. So bisphenol A has obviously been an important issue for a long time, so that's not the only thing that I've worked on, but it's a big one.
And Representative Zerwas, we did get a handout. I know, I think it was missing Dr. Wallinga's name, but it had a brief bio anyway.
I matched the photo up.
Yeah.
I'm a trained observer.
All right, Representative Zerwas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Dr. Wallinga, you're not a epidemiologist?
I'm a medical
Dr.
physician.
Wallinga.
Madam Chair, thank you. I'm not an epidemiologist. I'm trained as a medical physician.
Okay.
Representative Zerwas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then I guess, so with the FDA not pushing for this ban in the canned goods for the BPAs, and we've had kind of conflicting testimony in some of their research, I'm wondering, you know, what makes, Dr. Wallinga, what makes you better staffed or equipped to answer health questions on broad-based populations of children than the Food and Drug Administration?
Dr. Wallinga.
Well, I'm not sure why we keep defaulting to FDA, but let me just go back and suggest that there are many other bodies that are also quite important in terms of assessing the state of the science. And I'm, in part, just translating what those other bodies have said. The National Toxicology Program is the federal program by NIH, the National Institutes of Health, that looks at environmental chemicals and figures out whether there's enough science to say whether they're a carcinogen or what the health impacts are. And when they did a 2008 report, looking at 700 studies and reviewing it, they expressed concern about bisphenol A's effects on brain behavior and prostate gland in fetuses, infants, and children at current levels of exposure. So what's significant to me is that they did a much more comprehensive review than the FDA did. And they're not the only group to reach similar conclusions. For example, I had mentioned the expert panel, the Chapel Hill consensus statement. I can give you a reference for that. That was 38 leading bisphenol A researchers, led to a similar conclusion. France has taken action by passing a recent ban on bisphenol A in products for children under 3 effective January 1st of this year, and for all food packaging with direct food contact by January 1, 2015. And then finally, California recently added BPA to its list of chemicals known to harm reproduction problems or cause cancer. And California, which is, you know, as big as many countries, made that determination, again, based on that 2000 report by the National Toxicology Program. So FDA is one body. Sure, it's an important body. It's not the only government body doing assessments of this chemical. So I think it's important to look at those other things as well.
Representative Mack had a question to this point, and then I guess Representative Zerwas has a follow-up, and then after that we're going to try to move along because we have 2 other bills to do.
Sure. Representative Mack. Very, very briefly, Madam Chair, I'm just wondering if maybe we could follow up afterwards and see some of the reports. It's my understanding, I just saw excerpts and things taken out from the NIH and the National Toxicology reports from 2008, but both of which were citing negligible levels of BPH. I'm trying to recall what specifically that was in reference to, but I'd love to just, you know, cross-check those documents because I don't know if I'm looking at something different, but it's, what I'm remembering is it's saying something different than what you're saying from those two bodies anyway. So thank you.
Okay, I'm Representative Zerwas, and then we've got Lohmer and Ward. Representative Zerwas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I was, it's like Representative Mack read my mind.
Okay.
I think that's the real question is, in looking back at those studies, they talk about exposure, and what one of the other testifiers talked about is exposure versus harmful exposure. And so I think we have this can of tuna. And we have the exposure from the can of tuna, and then we have a harmful exposure after 24,000 cans of tuna. And so I'm wondering if that, I think, seems to drill down to the heart of the equation, Doctor, is do you see the difference in exposing your baby or your small child to 24,000 cans of tuna or 500 cans of the soup a day? Versus one Chef Boyardee lunch.
Dr. Wallinger.
Yes, Madam Chair. Thank you. What I make it see the critical difference being is that a fetus or a young baby has a brain that's so much more vulnerable, and is at a point in development where everything has to happen just so. So we've known for decades, literally, that exposing an adult to a certain amount of lead and gasoline maybe didn't have any effect, but exposing a fetus or a young baby to that same small amount had quite profound effects. And what the science, if you track it, especially over the last 5 or 6 years is showing, is that bisphenol A looks kind of the same. That because it's a hormone, and think about if your family was ever on birth control pills, the amount of estrogen that makes that birth control pill work is really, really, really small. It's on the order of parts per billion. What we're talking about here is exposure to bisphenol A and estrogen that are parts per billion. So it's not surprising that it could have an impact, even though it's a small level of exposure, because that's how things like pharmaceuticals and birth control pills work too. So
Okay, can we, okay, Representative Zerwas, and then we're going to go back to Lohmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and if you indulge me, I guess I have a question for the other doctor that provided testimony, if we could have her come up, the epidemiologist.
Well, let me just see, Representative Lohmer, did you want to have a question? You had a question for Representative Atkins, I thought. Yes, maybe so she could do that one, and then we'll switch chairs again.
Perfect.
Representative Lohmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm on the right bill, but I did ask the wrong person, so I apologize for that. This is 459. And Representative Atkins, I guess going back to my question about unintended consequences, would there be liability for food shelves with your bill, passage of this bill?
Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Lohmer. I don't imagine liability for food shelves, but I do... I think it bears noting that I don't want to have, just because kids don't have money, I don't want them exposed to BPA any more than I want families like Ms. Spurgeon's that are very dedicated to finding appropriate products that are BPA-free. So I would, I'm glad that the bill would apply to products that are available at all locations, whether it's at a retail store or a food shelf. I don't want to have any child or infant exposed to BPA.
And Representative Lohmer, I've been reminded again that the bill has more stops to make, and commerce, it has judiciary, so I think that issue will be vetted. Representative Ward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was trying to follow the whole line of conversation here, so I just did a very quick search. Seven companies you can trust to use BPA-free cans. Eden Organic, most of Trader Joe's cans, including beans, soups and chilies, probably have some BPA. They're not, and Eden Organic is labeling theirs now BPA free.
Thank you, Representative Ward, and
so it can be done.
Yes, thank you. The wonders of technology here, sitting at the committee table, So, Representative Zerwas, we wanted to bring the other testifiers back, correct?
The epidemiologist. Yes, Madam Chair, thank you.
Okay, Dr. Goodman, welcome back.
Thank you.
Go ahead, Representative Zerwas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, to the good doctor, a follow-up question as far as with what we had talked about, what the other testifier talked about, when we're talking about parts per billion exposure, is that something or that in your research and your work that you've seen to be harmful, or is there something that needs to maybe be refuted here?
Absolutely
Dr.
not.
Goodman.
And I think some of the analogies that were made were incredibly inappropriate. For example, comparing this to DES or birth control pills is flat out wrong. These are drugs people take. People are deliberately taking high doses. These are also chemicals that have much higher levels of estrogenicity than BPA. So there's high, like we're saying, thousands of times more exposure and thousands of times more potency. So to say BPA is like taking these, you know, very tiny exposures from food versus deliberately taking high doses, it's just they're not even on the same table. And I guess the other thing, too, was the views of these other agencies were also misrepresented. NIEHS, National Institute for Environmental Health Sciences, which houses the National Toxicology Program, that study that he mentioned, they did review 700 studies, and that's true. But what was left out is that they actually, in their report, I'm just reading here because I had this... basically, they found no direct evidence for health effects in people. It confirmed that human exposure to BPA is very low. And essentially, what it did was it took a five-level scale of concern, from negligible concern to serious concern. And they reported no concerns for any age group, including infants or fetuses, at the top two levels of concern, and only negligible concern for adults. So the quotes he read were true, but the fact is they looked at all the data, and they... You know, if it was a real issue, it would have been on one of the, at least the second to highest level of concern, and it wasn't. Also, FDA started with that NIEHS report. It's been sort of implied that FDA didn't look at as much as they did. That was where they started and then looked at studies. That was published in 2008. All the studies published since then. They did not ignore any studies. They did not only look at industry studies. If you look at their report, it says the criteria it uses to judge studies, which is, you know, how many animals were used, the dosing, the So it's the criteria is not based on funding, it's based on study design. And it was on reviewing all of those studies that it found that human exposures were safe. So I think, you know, while some of the facts you heard were technically true, they were put in such a context that it made it seem like there's an issue where there really isn't one.
Okay. We have another question from Representative Johnson. And then I'm going to see if anybody else in the audience wants to testify for or against this bill, and then we're going to vote. I'm sorry, Representative Zerwas, you gave such a long answer, I thought you were done. Did that not maybe address your question?
Well, it was a good first answer, but I have a couple follow-up.
Just to let you know, we will come back this evening if we're not done with these bills. So if everybody's prepared to do that, go ahead. I'm sorry, Representative Clark. We'll let Representative Zerwas finish.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair. Do you believe Dr. Goodman's testimony is credible?
I am Dr. Goodman. So yes, but
I'm
hoping you not do it. No.
I apologize.
Not
you.
File 459.
But are you really sure?
I apologize. Okay. What's the other doctor?
Well,
what happened one of those days?
Yeah.
I apologize. Do you think the other testimony is credible? If they're not, if they're misrepresenting what the study actually says, and misrepresenting what they're looking at.
We're getting up to a fine line here that we generally don't cross among members, and I just want to
Thank you, Representative Atkins. I was about to say the same thing, and I think she did give quite a lengthy, I think, refutation of what she heard from the other side. So, you know, Representative Zerwas, I don't think we want to start asking testifiers if they think the other person is more credible. So,
fair enough.
If it's okay, then I'm going to go on to Representative Johnson. Okay, Representative Johnson.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Atkins, have any other states made a similar ban?
Representative Atkins.
Madam Chair, I believe that others are in the process or have done similar, but I don't know for sure what other states have done so.
Okay. Is there anybody in the audience who wants to testify for or against this bill? All right. Seeing none, do we have somebody who wants to say
something? No, I got a little help. Connecticut and Vermont have already done this. Thank you for the question.
I'm sorry, Representative Atkins, who?
Connecticut
and Vermont. Okay. So any closing comments for us before we vote, Representative Atkins?
Madam Chair, in light of the fact you've got two more bills, this is a good bill. The science is there, and I'd appreciate members' support.
All right. I will renew my motion that House File 459 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Judiciary Committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, no.
No.
The motion prevails, and the bill is passed to Judiciary. Thank you, Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Okay, we have House File 458, and is Representative Purcell here? And Representative Purcell, welcome to the committee. And I'm going to move Representative Purcell's bill. I move that House File 458 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Judiciary Committee. And Representative Purcell, do you have an author's amendment that you want to get the bill in some other form here before we begin discussing it?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, I don't know that I have that amendment right in front of me, so I'm not sure if we're going to do that right now.
Okay.
Okay, we do have.
Okay.
All right. Do you have the amendment, Madam Chair?
I do, Representative Purcell, and this is the A1 amendment.
And so members?
I will move the A1 amendment to get the...
And members?
I will move the A1 amendment to get the bill in the form in which Representative Purcell would like to discuss it.
Yes.
Or unless you want to discuss the amendment first.
I'm fine if you move that. Okay. We can vote on that if
you'd
like. All right.
So I'll make that motion. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, no. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. So now that we have the bill in the form in which the author would like, Representative Purcell, please go ahead and present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And not without trepidation, I use Representative Erdahl's phrase, this is a simple little bill. we'll see. So, if members have had an opportunity, Madam Chair, to look at the amendment, we've tried to clarify in working with folks around this issue. So, what we're doing here with formaldehyde in children's products is an effort similar to what much of what you just heard in the previous testimony on the previous bill, trying to protect children's health, and the chemical formaldehyde is certainly found in natural settings, and but it's also used in some products and not in others. There's evidence out there now that some of these personal care products for children are being advertised as you heard in the previous testimony on the previous bill that don't contain formaldehyde. So there's some recognition that formaldehyde's not necessarily a good thing, especially when it's inhaled. So our effort here is to have that formaldehyde eliminated from children's personal care products. And I'm not going to go on and on and on. I mean, that's the thrust of it. So I would just offer, if we've got some questions, and I'll try and answer those, and we're going to try and make this thing the best bill it can be and get it to the end. So
thank you, Representative Purcell. Representative Albright.
Yes, I'd like to speak to the House File 458. Representative Purcell, what amount of formaldehyde is found in these products that you're speaking to?
Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I don't have a part per million or part per trillion to put in front of you, but if you have some information to share with me, I'll listen.
No, not on this one. No. If I wanted to talk about 459, I certainly could.
I would, Madam Chair, I would add that, you know, I sat there for a long time listening to the previous testimony, and I wanted to jump up a couple of times and talk about how fetuses are exposed from day 35 to 55 and how the organogenesis goes on and cell formation, billions and billions of cells. That's the part we're concerned about with that. But I'm not going to go there, but I was quite interested. We were talking about parts per million and parts per billion. And I had a little sidebar with Representative Grunhagen, and I'll try not to stray too far, Madam Chair, but this is really I had a little sidebar with Representative Grunhagen and about chemicals in general, and I said, Representative Grunhagen, both of us being veterans, I said, do you remember Agent Orange? Remember what they said about Agent Orange when we come back from Vietnam? No problem. How many years, how many decades did they say that about Agent Orange? How many veterans are in their coffins because of Agent Orange? So I just bring that up. And Agent Orange, the toxic product of Agent Orange, is harmful at parts per trillion. That's another three zeros out there. So I'll quit right there for now.
All right. Well, Representative Purcell, maybe we should bring up the other testifiers. Is that okay, Representative Albright?
I'm yes.
Okay. So we've got some people on the list to testify. We've got Mr. Hackman, and Mr. Quillis again is going to testify on this one. That's what I understood. You have a testifier as well, Representative Purcell, correct? Okay. Sorry,
yes, ma'am.
She wasn't on the list here, so I didn't realize. But okay, go ahead. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Hi, Madam Chair. I'm Kathleen Schuler. I'm a senior policy analyst with the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy, and I'm co-director of Healthy Legacy, which is a statewide public health coalition dedicated to safe products made safely. We have a diverse membership, including the Minnesota Public Health Association, the Minnesota Council of Churches, the Learning Disability Association, our Greater Twin Cities, the Minnesota Nurses Association, and many others. We all know that chemicals play an important role in our lives, giving us modern and convenient products that benefit our lives in many ways. Unfortunately, we are experiencing the unintended consequences of untested chemicals in thousands of consumer products, including those designed for children. Our state and federal regulatory systems are failing to protect us from the introduction of toxic chemicals into our products and our bodies. The Department of Health has acknowledged risks to children from 9 priority chemicals that children are commonly exposed to. The list was derived from a larger list of 1,756 chemicals that were determined by authoritative sources to persist in the environment, to accumulate in wildlife, food, and the human body, or are toxic to human health, meaning that their exposure puts our health at risk for cancer, reproductive or developmental problems, hormone disruption, or adverse effects on brain and immune system. This list includes formaldehyde, a chemical that has been declared a carcinogen by the World Health Organization, International Agency for Research on Cancer. It also causes respiratory problems, and short-term exposure can cause wheezing, eye, nose, throat, and skin irritation. Chronic exposure is associated with asthma and higher risk for certain types of cancer. In one study, school children were exposed to formaldehyde became sensitized, and they experienced an array of adverse symptoms, including headache, nose bleeding, rhinitis, fatigue, cough, etc. And these were correlated with the amount of formaldehyde concentrations in the classroom. That's just one example. While all of us are exposed to formaldehyde from various products, we're most concerned about young children who are more vulnerable, and you heard from Dr. Wallinga, they're more vulnerable to harm from toxic chemical exposures because they have immature immune systems and their bodies are still developing. This bill would eliminate one important source of formaldehyde exposure for young children. Although formaldehyde itself is not directly added to kids' personal care products, there are scores of chemicals that are used as preservatives that release formaldehyde when the product is used. Quaternium 15 is one example. DMDM, hydantoin is another example. They all have long chemical names. Most parents are probably not going to look for them on the label or even know to look for them. So if a parent tries to buy formaldehyde-free products, they're really not going to be able to have that information available to them handily. So that isn't feasible for them, and it's definitely not right. These products should be formaldehyde-free so parents don't have to worry. We found numerous products on Minnesota's store shelves that contain formaldehyde-releasing chemicals, including baby shampoo, bubble bath, soap, and body wash. We know that safer alternatives for preservatives and personal care products are available. Many companies are already using them. Johnson & Johnson, to their credit, has committed to phasing out formaldehyde-releasing chemicals in their children's personal care products by the end of 2013. And many companies have already phased them out. We'd like to make sure all the products are safe and free of formaldehyde so parents have one less thing to worry about. They can be assured that they can shop for bubble bath or soap or baby shampoo without worrying that it will expose their children to formaldehyde. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. We're going to take Mr. Hackman, who I understand needs to catch a flight someplace. So we'll get him in, and then and Mr. Hackman, just so you know, we have about 1 minute left in this hearing.
I will be prompt. I need to get back to Maryland to my 4-year-old daughter tonight, so I appreciate you taking me out of order.
The committee.
And I'm going to speak to two bills if you'll indulge me on that.
Okay.
Again, my name is Andy Hackman. I'm here on behalf of the Toy Industry Association. I'm going to testify on House File 458 and House File 605. A quick comment. We represent the entire toy industry that manufactures, sells, and distributes toys here in the United States. We have over 130 toy manufacturers here in Minnesota and support over 3,000 jobs. on 458, the formaldehyde legislation. We've worked with the proponents. We still need a little bit of a tweak on the language there to make sure we reference toys in the correct way, but we're getting there, and we appreciate the proponents working with us on that language. On House File 605, the broader chemical regulation piece of legislation, I'll underscore that toys are safe and are regulated at the federal level for 5 of the 9 chemicals that are identified under the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency's chemical program. There's extensive federal regulation of all the materials that go into toys. As a father myself of a 4-year-old daughter, I feel confident in the federal network that we have to ensure toy safety. The legislation is currently drafted. It would be the broadest chemicals regulation statute in the country right now. There are a few other states that have begun to do work in this area, but we need some significant change still to the language that's before you. I've had a brief chance to look at the language regarding the amendments. Washington State is probably seen as the closest to being a reasonable program for at least reporting chemicals of concern in children's products. The amendment gets us close but doesn't get us there yet. We really need 100% consistency with Washington State's program such that we don't have to spend another $27 million testing our products just to do paperwork to show the state, to show our retail partners that we don't have the chemicals of concern in our products. So we need 100% consistency on the reporting provisions. We question whether or not the alternatives assessment provisions and the ban provisions are necessary at this time until the state can collect and analyze that data. So we do continue to have concerns with those provisions, and I can answer any questions you have about toys, our safety, and again, I appreciate the indulgence of the committee in taking me early tonight.
Thank you very much, and Mr. Hackman, and if you have written testimony that you can leave with us, and if you can give that to the page, they can make copies, and then we'll have that available for us now and later on. Thank you. Representative Mack has a question.
Just one quick question for you, Mr. Hackman. In regards to the bill in front of us, I understand formaldehyde is naturally occurring in many things, one of which is wood products. Wood toy blocks, for instance. My child, wood toys are becoming more and more popular as an alternative plastics. My daughter has a lot of those. What would this bill do to wood blocks, wood toys?
The language is intended to go after cosmetics, as I understand it. We've worked with the proponents to clarify that and make that consistent. If this were to be expanded to go after all products, naturally occurring formaldehyde, the way the language is developed, it's a complete ban. So there would be a problem with the wood in the desk, the wooden toy block, etc., because formaldehyde is naturally occurring. It's in bananas. It's in anything that grows out of the earth, basically. So, but we're working with the proponents to make sure that it's clarified and that CPSC's authority, in essence, over our product category is recognized.
Okay, thank you. All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Hackman.
Thank you.
Members, we are past our time, so we're going to recess the committee now. We're going to return at 6 o'clock p.m., but we're going to be in room 10 this evening. So please do come back at 6 p.m. in room 10, and we are in recess. All right, the committee is going to come back to order, and we are still hearing House File 458. And I realize that we're a little low on our attendance here. There are a lot of competing things. Some members are in other committees here in the building, and this kind of thing happens to those of you who are familiar around. As we get close to deadlines, often we have multiple committees going, and people are in more than one place at a time. But I'd like to get finished with these two bills if we can. And so Representative Purcell, let's see, we heard from Mr. Hackman. I don't know if Mr. Twillis is here. I'm sorry, Twillis, and wants to testify on this bill, and then we can take some more questions. Welcome back to the committee, Mr. Twillis, and if you want to go ahead, I just want to say I don't think you need to repeat anything that you testified on the other bill, and that was more comprehensive, which I appreciate. So welcome back, and go ahead and introduce yourself.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tony Quillis. I'm the Director of Environmental Policy at the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. And again, like I said before, we think that we should do this chemical regulation should be done at the federal level rather than a state-by-state, chemical-by-chemical. Formaldehyde is very heavily regulated on the international and federal level. want to just point out also that no other state has done the proposal regulation of formaldehyde before you, and that it's naturally occurring in the environment. It's in bananas, it's in apples, it's in apricots. And we do have some concerns with the bill. I've talked to Representative Purcell with them. I understand that there are a number of stops along the way and have agreed to work with them to try and address those concerns as the bill moves through the process, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Quillis. I appreciate that. And, of course, that's why we do these committees, is so that we can work on the bills and hopefully by the end of the process have something that is workable. So any questions from members? All right. Representative Albright? Whatever you want to talk about, Representative Albright.
Really? You can talk whatever?
Any of the three.
All right. Representative Purcell, in your bill on line 1.2, actually I'll start on 1.19. It talks about ingredients that chemically degrade under normal conditions of temperature and pressure to release formaldehyde. And so my question is, what exactly does that mean? And if you could, I understand your background may not lend itself to answering the question, but you can certainly follow up with me from an expert in terms of, can you give us some more additional specificity on that point, or in layman's terms, what does that really mean, Representative?
Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Albright. As you just heard from Mr. Quillis, there are any number of natural forms or products, if you will, that's not the right word, things that have formaldehyde in them. And formaldehyde is a degradation product of organogenesis. In other words, anything that's organic can have formaldehyde as a product of degradation. So that's a succinct answer I'd give you. And I want to clarify one thing that Mr. Quillis said, though, in citing that apricots and other fruits and products have formaldehyde in them, and they do. What we're endeavoring to do in this bill is to eliminate them in children's personal care products, which is an inhalation issue, not a consumption ingestion issue.
Thank you, Representative Purcell. And members and to the audience, the buzzing you hear is somebody's transmitting electronic object. So this room's very sensitive to that. So if you have a cell phone and you could just turn it off, or I think putting it on airplane mode might be a good start, and see if that helps. So we would appreciate that, because this can be really annoying. I've spent a lot of time in this room lately. So, okay, Representative Albright.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I'm not to be belligerent on this point, Representative Purcell, but if we are trying to prevent children under the age of 12 from coming in contact with formaldehyde, and for the sake of when it naturally occurs, carrots, apricots, apples, what have you, is there a discernible amount that we're trying to, from a quantify, is there a discernible amount that we're trying to prevent a child from inhaling, or is it just that we just want to prevent all without regard to any type of quantifiable, objective, scientific proof that a certain amount is good or is acceptable, but beyond that is not acceptable?
Representative
Purcell. Madam Chair, Representative Albright, as you may recall from your analytical chemistry in high school or college, we can't measure zero.
That was just yesterday, by the way. But.
So there are definitely issues, and when we set standards for water quality or other parameters, that there definitely are times when we can say we have a quantity. But this isn't one of them. What we're endeavoring to do is to get these formaldehyde out of the children's products to the best of our ability to do so. And we know there are other exposures out in the grocery stores, as there are with many other contaminants. But what we're trying to do is keep these products out of these personal care products where they are put into an aerosol or aerosolized form, and you have a shampoo, and you smell that shampoo, right? That's something that's given off. It's a volatile organic of some kind. Probably has some formaldehyde in it, if that product is known to contain formaldehyde from the outset. That's part of that. There are products that are on the market that don't have formaldehyde in them. They're labeled so. They don't have formaldehyde in them. Can they be measured at the parts per quadrillion level to not have formaldehyde? Probably can't get the science around that. You probably can't have a quality assurance plan in any analytical chemistry lab that's going to get you down to parts per quad. That's 15 zeros on the right side of the decimal. Not going to happen. But reasonably, we're talking about reasonable human beings here, and how are we going to proceed in getting these out of personal care products for children? And we have this opportunity to do it, and that's the goal of this bill.
All right, and I think Ms. Schuler wants to jump in here.
Madam Chair, Representative, I just wanted to add that the intention is that their ingredients in a children's personal care product, not naturally occurring. These are things that are added to the product. So chemicals that release formaldehydes that are intentionally added as ingredients.
Okay, thank you. Representative Albright?
Just two questions, and then I'll just bide my time. So, Representative Purcell, and to the testifier then, has the FDA or the Consumer Product Safety Council restricted the use of formaldehyde already? And are these definitions or this intent initiative going beyond that which is already in statute by virtue of the FDA?
Representative Purcell.
If I may, Madam Chair, I just want to, I'll respond the way I know how to respond to this, and then I'll let Ms. Schuler respond. The classic case that I recall, Representative Albright, from formaldehyde exposure was after Hurricane Katrina, and you may recall that there were FEMA trailers that were taken down there, and the paneling board in those trailers made people pretty sick. That was formaldehyde that did that. So we do have a very good understanding that formaldehyde can make people pretty sick, and maybe back in that chemistry lab you got a whiff of something that was inside of a jar in formaldehyde, and it maybe set you on your butt, maybe it didn't, but it sure took your breath away. So that's what we're talking about. And to children, that's what's problematic. And I'll let Ms. Schuler.
Ms. Schuler.
I just wanted to add, Madam Chair, Representative, the federal agencies aren't currently regulating formaldehyde in these products. And what we're trying to do is set a level of protection for children so they don't have this inhalation exposure.
Thank you.
Just one follow-up.
Representative Albright.
And it goes to the point of what you just said then, and what Representative Purcell said about the FEMA trailers, and also then to tag on to what you just said about if the FDA isn't currently restricting it, then my concluding question is why?
Ms. Schuler?
We'll probably get both of us, Madam Chair, but that my simple answer is because we know it's problematic. We know it's problematic for children to inhale formaldehyde, and as was said, that it's the ingredients that we're trying to work with here to keep them out of these products, and it's quite doable.
And Madam Chair, Representative. Some of the manufacturers, as I mentioned before, Johnson & Johnson is phasing it out because of concerns by consumers and also concerns for the health effects of children breathing in formaldehyde. We just want to assure that all the products are safe. If they aren't Johnson & Johnson, we want all of them to be free of formaldehyde.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Representative Mack.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a brief question. I don't know if this was covered before. What is the purpose of formaldehyde being offered? And taking it out, does it compromise the integrity of the product and need to be replaced with something else?
Ms. Schuler.
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Mack. It's used as a preservative, and there are alternative preservatives that are safer. We do have a product fact sheet, which we can distribute if you'd like to see that.
Yeah, Ms. Schuler, I think that would be a good thing. Do you have copies?
Yes.
Okay. All right, other questions? Okay. All right, is there anybody in the audience who wants to testify for or against this bill? Okay. Not seeing any takers and seeing no further questions, I think we're ready to take a vote on this bill. So our Representative Purcell renews his motion that House File 458, as amended, be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Judiciary Committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, no.
No.
Motion prevails and the bill is passed. Thank you, Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Now we are going to move on to House File 605, Representative Winkler. I think Mr. Bergeron just went to get him, so we'll just give him a moment. So I'm going to move House File 605 and see that it be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Judiciary Committee. So, welcome, Representative Winkler.
Would you be open to a referral to civil law first? Because we may not need to go to Judiciary if civil law takes care of this.
Okay, I'll change my motion then, Representative Winkler, and I'll move that it be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Civil Law. So, and then you have an author's amendment?
Madam Chair, that's correct. It's a DE1.
Okay, so I will move the DE1 amendment to put the bill in the shape in which the author would like to discuss it. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Motion prevails, and the amendment is adopted. And then I see there is another amendment. Is that something we should deal with now? No. Okay. Representative Winkler, go ahead and present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. It's my understanding that you have probably had extensive testimony and discussion today about two priority chemicals, bisphenol A and formaldehyde. And I don't think we need to go into a long and detailed explanation about the concerns, the health concerns that people have about those chemicals. What this bill does, what House File 605 does, is to avoid the current method of waiting until we are convinced that something is very dangerous and then passing special legislation to phase it out, and instead adopt an ongoing system for the Departments of Health and the Pollution Control Agency to identify chemicals that are priorities for removal from children's products, to permit the or require industry and to permit these agencies to report on which of these priority chemicals are in which products, and then to phase them out over time. And I'm happy to go through the details of the bill, but essentially it's to set up a process by which these things happen without the legislature having to weigh in every few years whenever scientific evidence mounts and political will permits us to act. And so I would ask for your favorable consideration. I do have a testifier if he wants to chime in, but it's evening and you've talked about this all day.
Okay. Well, whatever is your pleasure, and we do have questions. I don't know, maybe we... Okay, well, let's just take the questions. Representative Mack.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And it's just to the DE1 amendment, and maybe this is to the author. I know that this was, and I know we don't have a 24-hour rule in this committee, and appreciate the flexibility of that. I know this was time-stamped yesterday, wasn't posted until this morning, which makes it a little difficult to, and it seems like there's some deviations, obviously, with the DE1 amendment from the original bill, and so I'm wondering if the author can kind of explain to us the major differences between the original bill and the DE1, maybe reasons for those changes or where we're looking at big differences. It's just with a busy day and the late posting and a little difficult for me and maybe some in the public to know exactly what we're dealing with here on short notice. So,
sure.
Madam Chair, Representative Mack, thank you for not using that dreaded word, transparency, which I certainly have never used. I will say that one of the primary changes in the DE1 is to better align the reporting requirements with reporting requirements in Washington State so that there is less difference between states. And this is in response to the toy industry, Big Tonka or whatever you want to call them, who had some concerns about reporting and wanting to limit their costs and still provide for that level of information. But as to more of the specific changes between the DE1 and the original version of the bill, I would turn to my testifier to see if there are other highlights besides that that are important.
Okay. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Dan Andreessen, representing the Healthy Legacy Coalition. The biggest changes you'll see, there's a small change in Section 2 with adding in a few definitions that come up later in the bill, but the most substantial changes will be on page 5, section 6, with the timing and the material that would be reported to state agencies. Again, we're trying to get this in line with what industry is already starting to follow with the state of Washington. We work closely with state agencies to get this language as close as we can to that. I believe they'll be testifying on this section of the bill as well, so they could probably answer more specific questions on it. But that was the reason for the amendment.
Okay, Representative Mack. Okay, so thank you. So other questions, members? Representative Albright? Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Winkler, to your witness. We heard a little bit about how Washington State is kind of doing things ahead, and I think when we can partner with good standards, I think that makes sense. But I'm looking on page 5, and the timing requirements and those sorts of things, and we put a manufacturer and a distributor in the same category. And to me, a manufacturer who churns out millions of toys or billions, I don't know how many kids and how big some of these manufacturers are, to me has a different sort of volume thing going than a distributor who is one of a number usually of cogs in the distribution chain, and yet we set the same breaks for the two, and I'm just wondering why that is, because it seems to me it's more responsibility on the manufacturer. For a distributor, they have responsibilities, I would assume, to not distribute in our state once something has been, posted as having an issue. I'm just trying to understand those two different actors, which in my head, and I'm not a commerce expert, seems to have different responsibilities and would have different levels just to begin with.
Who's going to take that? Mr. Andreessen.
Madam Chair, Representative Loeffler, I may have to concede to agency folk on this that this is the language that we are working with them, so they may have a better idea as to kind of what degree this is from Washington's and how industry is already working with Washington on this issue.
Madam Chair, this is
Representative Winkler.
Representative Loeffler, I guess an important point here is that you're setting the same dollar amounts for both, and so for a distributor to be hitting the same targets as a manufacturer, they would obviously have to be a major player in the commercial stream in order to qualify for this kind of reporting. So I think, you know, I don't think you're dealing with big manufacturers and small distributors. I think they're all have to be of certain scale in the in commerce in order to hit these reporting requirements. That helps to address the question.
Madam Chair?
Representative Loeffler.
Well, in the earlier bills, we actually had kind of different time frames because the thought was that, you know, a manufacturer must cease manufacturing at a certain point, and then you had some period for inventory to dissipate that's already been distributed. And I don't see that kind of distinction in this, which to me seemed like a reasonable sort of process by which one would, you know, a chemical is identified as a priority concern based on new scientific evidence. And so, you know, you first try and stop the pipeline, and then, you know, the ability for us to get information to all the potential distributors, little five and dime dollar stores, whatever, I think is somewhat limited. And so I'm just kind of trying to think through the practical applications. I assume that you will have to ultimately end up, if you keep going along, into the Commerce Committee, but I would really think we need to think about that because, you know, we are going to have small retail outlets who will want to comply but have sometimes the difficulty kind of understanding what the rules are.
Okay, Representative Winkler.
Madam Chair, Representative Loeffler, I think two important points here. One is that, you know, this is just the reporting section, so we are talking about people who are of sufficient scale, and they're not trying to get rid of inventory. They just have to report on what is in the products. And second of all, to use a favored expression from our friends on the Republican side, from my work in the private sector, I would say that distributor tends to not be a retailer, but is more somebody in between the manufacturer and the retail level. It's, you know, we have distribution agreements, and they are out there trying to open up markets. And so distributors can be extremely large, and they're usually not like a Walgreens or something like that. That would be a separate kind of retailer, and certainly not a five and dime type shop. But I take your concern, and if there is something that we can do to make it work better, certainly we're open to that.
Thank you.
Okay. Other questions, members? Representative Albright?
Just a rundown of some questions that I've been eager to ask on 605. How many chemicals of high concern are there?
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, chemicals of high concern, I think there are actually quite a large number, certainly more than the nine that are the priority chemicals.
Madam Chair, Representative
Mr.
Albright.
Mr. Andreessen.
1,756.
Could you repeat that one more time?
1,756.
Madam Chair.
Representative Albright.
So, based upon that, how many products sold on the retail market contain those 1,756?
Mr. Andreessen.
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, that's kind of what we're trying to figure out with this bill. The reporting will hopefully bring out that information. We know that these nine chemicals are being used in kids' products, but we need a little bit more information. That's what agencies are looking to gather. So that's an answer we're hoping to get.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Obviously, the EPA must be involved. Do they have some type of working knowledge in terms of how they are going to approach this issue?
Representative
Madam Chair,
Winkler.
Representative Albright, the EPA does have lists of priority chemicals, and in fact, we're not asking if the state agencies to reinvent the wheel. They can rely on the work of federal agencies, but they're not directly involved in regulating products that are sold on shelves.
Madam Chair.
Representative Albright.
And I guess my point isn't in terms of the products on the shelves, but just the enormity of the process, because at least to me, my last question, would this not be the purview of the MPCA?
Mr. Andreessen.
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, both the PCA and Department of Health would be involved in the reporting.
Madam Chair.
Representative Winkler.
Representative Albright, I did misspeak. I said the EPA is not directly involved. They do have TSCA, which is a federal act, but it's relatively, let's say, low penetration in terms of toxic chemicals right now. But, it, you know, it's not the same thing as the FDA, for example, which is regulating pharmaceuticals, where you have to do rigorous clinical testing and provide you know, enormous volumes of safety data before you can put a product on the shelf. It's very different from that regulatory environment.
Representative Albright?
So would there be a fiscal note attached to this based upon the work that the PCA is going to need to do?
Representative Winkler.
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, there certainly will be a fiscal note, which we will deal with in the appropriate committees.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Other questions, members? Representative Mack.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just wondering, and wasn't able to locate it in the bill, but maybe you can help me. I'm wondering if this bill considers when risks from a chemical are stringently controlled and no further regulatory action would be necessary. Does it provide for that, whether at the federal level something trumps what the state's done or essentially mitigates the problem, just looking to eliminate chances of waste or redundant work on behalf of the state departments. Wondering if the bill provides for that.
Mr. Andreessen.
Madam Chair, Representative Mack, there is a provision in the bill that allows businesses to apply for a waiver under a certain criteria. That's on Section 11, that's page 10. So that may be an avenue that they want to pursue if they feel like they can't meet the requirements.
Representative Mack.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess just one of the concerns, and I have understood this, that this will be one of the most far-reaching or the most far-reaching legislation on this issue in the state. I know California, Washington, a few other states, but this will be the most extensive of this type. And Representative Winkler, I don't think you got to be in the hearing earlier where we had a testifier from the toy industry. I'm forgetting his name. I'm sure you've been in touch with them because you referenced working with them earlier.
Andy Hackman.
There you go, Mr. Hackman. And he just referenced kind of the necessity of streamlining and having pretty identical legislation to other states. And I think you allude to the fact that some of the DE1 amendment makes us more similar to the Washington model, but I guess my concern is, Mr. Hackman's not here to follow up, and maybe we can down the road here, but to follow up on what has been taken care of in the DE1 and where there's still differences, kind of a piecemeal approach across the country on this issue, especially when FDA is already doing things and now each state's doing their own thing. Doesn't necessarily seem to be the best way forward, either for consumers and what could be confusing and creating a disadvantage from state to state for businesses and manufacturers. And I guess I'm just concerned that this is going to result in an environment of unpredictable and costly chemical reporting burdens that are different from other states, and that's going to hurt our 150 toy manufacturers here in Minnesota. We're maybe making a mountain out of an issue that we're not going to really be capturing or solving as big of a problem as we're making it out to be. And I'm just wondering if there's a more logical approach in terms of getting closer to what other states have and lessening the burden on our toy manufacturers and business providers.
Representative Winkler.
Madam Chair, Representative Mack, in talking with the toy industry, I certainly indicated my willingness to further refine the reporting section to make it more closely in line and work better for their industry. I mean, our goal is not obviously to create a burden for the sake of creating a burden. The goal is to create safety. And so I'm open to more changes to that. And I think maybe the Commerce Committee is a good place to do some of those things. And I guess to your broader point, we're supposed to have laboratories of the states to help work out the best way of doing things. And this is an example of where we can do that. And industry is very good at lobbying Congress when they want to have federal supremacy and to lock out state regulations. So I think it's okay to kind of start down this path, and we'll see where we get. But I'm sure their voice will be heard very clearly in other states, in Minnesota, and in Washington.
Madam Chair?
Representative Mack.
And Representative, Madam Chair, Representative Winkler, I haven't had a chance to look at it, and we'll try to do that before the next committee stop or the floor.
are you amenable to possibly doing an identical version to Washington, or are there particular points that you take issue with that you want Minnesota to deviate from? Are there particular points that you would want to deviate from Washington on this?
Representative Winkler.
Madam Chair, Representative Mack, I frankly do not have as good a detailed information about exactly what Washington has done. My point would be to make it as similar as possible so as to not create undue burdens on the industry that don't provide any additional health benefit. So, I mean, that's kind of the standard I would bring. I don't have the details for you, but my overall philosophy is try to meet the outcome as much as possible and lessen the cost if we can.
Okay. And last question, Madam Chair. Just on process, I guess, one, will this come to Health and Human Services Finance, do you imagine? And two, my question is, have you requested a fiscal note yet on this?
Representative Wink.
Madam Chair, Representative Mack, a fiscal note, I believe, has been requested. I think it probably will go to HHS Finance at some point because it does involve the Health Department. So that would be my guess. But, you know, we will find out.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Mack. You have something else, Representative Walker?
I do. Representative Winkler, on page 5 of the DE1, line 5.1, talks about annual production of which is less than 3,000 units. I'm just curious as to why that threshold was established and the thinking behind it.
Mr. Andreessen.
Madam Chair, Representative Albright. This is regarding folks who are kind of in the hand trade. We heard some concerns from them that this bill may impact folks who hand make products for sale, like at a church function or some other kind of community function. And so that's why this is in that bill. The 3,000 units is a number that was taken from Michigan with some legislation regarding handmade products.
Representative Babler.
Oh, thanks, Madam Schmatzlau. Maybe it's just getting late in the day. I didn't speak on either of the other two bills. I just have a general thought I wanted to offer. I'm a co-author on this. Some week, there's something that occurs to me, though. If we pass this, we may have to go to Wisconsin and get the good toys. You know, we have to get the good fireworks there, and we have the cute ones here at Sparkle.
They can't sell them in Wisconsin, but except people from Minnesota, Representative Abler.
Thank you. But anyway, I just hated to waste that joke, but thank you for making it better. But, you know, here we are. Poison is poison, you know. I drink this water because it doesn't have. It tastes better than the tap water. And there's nothing unpoisoned about the poison about the city water, but chlorine and just doesn't taste as good. And there's some negatives to that. So if I just took one drop of oil and put it in here, it'd only be one drop of oil, and it'd be mostly water, and I should be happy with that. It's virtually water. I mean, it's how many trillion parts it would be or whatever, but we don't know why we get sick. You look at all the data. Cancer is growing. We used to be rare. And so we live in a world that we're accustomed to chemicals. And we heard today we should put epoxy inside of our cans, that's what they told me it was, so that they don't have the beans erode the tin, which I think is probably a good idea. I don't know, maybe they don't. Anyway.
They make your face better, Representative Abel.
Thank you, yeah, get your iron. It's just as we go through these things, I'm not going to debate the point, but I just tell you my bias here. We're trying to go out of our way to make sure we don't ruin anybody's business. We don't want to put 5 canneries out of business or 3,000 toy makers or whoever. But at some point, we don't want to poison ourselves. And there used to be a commercial on TV that said something about, without chemicals, life itself would be virtually impossible. Well, really, that was one of the, it was for Monsanto or somebody. You know, and we don't know all the effects. You don't know the long-term effects of these small chemicals or low levels of radiation or all the things that we subject ourselves to or even this sort of thing. And people discuss it, and always the people from the, according to the cell phone manufacturers, these are perfectly safe. According to Sweden, they're not safe at all, which is why I use a wire. So I don't have my brain dissolve worse than it is now. But anyway, so I just want to remind people why I was being author of this thing and why I wish you well in your quest to at least make it a little better. And we can't ruin the economy. We have to stay open and all that. But you know, that's why I like labeling, and so people can choose. They want to pay twice as much for a toy that doesn't have one of these products in it. Well, they should have the freedom to know that it's in there. So, good luck, and thanks for bringing it forward, and I'll just an editorial comment, so thank you.
Thank you. Representative Mack.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I apologize. I meant to ask this earlier. I'm just wondering, Representative Winkler, if there's been any consideration to, I'm thinking about products used possibly in hospitals, feeding tubes, a lot of equipment that I don't know anything about but are made of plastics, most likely, possibly have BPA in them. I don't know. I thought about this afternoon and couldn't get the information as quickly as I liked, but are there allowances for things like that, things that hospitals depend on, and if we were to ban or eliminate, could really create some unintended consequences pretty quickly?
Representative Winkler.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Mack, if you turn to page 4, lines 4.23 and 4.24. No, sorry. Oh, sorry, 4.21 to 4.22 does exempt medical devices as defined in the FDA Act. So it, you know, and if there's a further need for additional exemptions for, you know, products that are essential to human health, I'm certainly open to that. I think when we passed this bill a couple of years, or a similar or earlier version of this bill a few years ago, there was a concern from Medtronic about some of those things, and we exempted that, and I support that. I've got a kid with an insulin pump, and whether or not there's BPA in that, I want him to be able to get insulin. So.
Yeah, thank you. We have some more testifiers. So we have Tony Quillis, and we have Dr. Goodman again, and then we have Shannon Lotthammer. So let's have Mr. Quillis and maybe Dr. Goodman, if she's still here.
Madam Chair, Dr. Goodman, I think, had to catch a flight out of town or had another a previous commitment, so I apologize for her. And again, Madam Chair, I will be brief. I'm Tony Quillis, Director of Environmental Policy at the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. I want to thank Representative Winkler for the DE1 amendment. He and I have had some brief discussions about some of the concerns that the Chamber had and has moved to address some of those concerns, not all of them, but and we will, as we've had discussions previously, we'll keep moving, talking as the bill moves through the process. But, Madam Chair, again, especially on this one, with what Representative Winkler referenced TSCA, which is the Toxic Substance Control Act, because we're not just talking about chemicals here or just an individual one. We're talking about, as you heard, the breadth of thousands of chemicals. An effect of, and Representative Loeffler pointed it out, between distributors and manufacturers. We're worried about some conflicting and confusing and costly reports. If you remember, he had to go very quickly, but Mr. Hackman referenced the in California alone, his industry, it was $27 million the first year and $69 million just for the toy industry in the out years to comply with the law in California. So. And for that cost, they didn't change one bit of any of their products for all that testing. So there wasn't any protection of public health, but a lot of cost involved. So, you know, we have some concerns about that. In the bill itself, we want to just make sure, as we've Representative Winkler's referenced, you've referenced it here, to make sure as we go through that we're not making any redundancies or duplicating in the reporting. There are, we've referenced Washington a couple of times. There are some issues with, maybe not with the toy industry, but with other folks with Washington. So I'd like to address those with Representative Winkler as it moves through. Obviously, the sale prohibition in here. And then, Madam Chair, probably the biggest concern, we talked about the fiscal note, but the business community gets a little concerned when we have fees and the numbers are open-ended and there's nothing on them. So we have a little bit concerned about that. We look forward to seeing the fiscal note when it moves forward. But again, thank you to Representative Winkler for kind of moving towards some and addressing some of our concerns, and we look forward to working with him as the bill moves through the process. And I'm not going to promise anything, but I think we might be able to find an area. But I don't know.
Okay. All right, Mr. Quillis. Thank you. Thank you for sticking around. We have Shannon Lotthammer from the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Shannon Lotthammer. I'm the Director of the Environmental Analysis and Outcomes Division at the Pollution Control Agency. And the mission of the Pollution Control Agency is working with Minnesotans to protect, conserve, and improve our environment and protect our quality of life. And protecting public health from environmental hazards, particularly vulnerable populations such as children, is foundational to achieving this overall mission. Therefore, the Pollution Control Agency is very supportive of efforts to enhance understanding of the presence of priority chemicals in children's products and to provide information to Minnesotans so they can make informed choices about the products that they purchase and they use. So the PCA supports the reporting requirements that are included in House File 605. The reporting requirements are consistent with a report that the Pollution Control Agency and the Department of Health developed back in 2010 under the original Toxic Free Kids Act, and that included recommendations for options for enhancing understanding and reducing and phasing out priority chemicals in children's products. The first recommendation in that 2010 report was that the legislature consider actions to require manufacturers that produce or sell children's products in Minnesota that contain one or more of those priority chemicals to report that information that is about the chemicals that are contained in those products. The requirements in the proposed bill would provide such reporting, and that reporting is needed to provide information about the presence of priority chemicals in children's products. You'll remember some of the testimony from earlier today about the consumer that was interested in knowing about that information so that she could make choices for her family. So that reporting helps provide that information so to help inform consumers so that they can avoid products that contain priority chemicals if they so choose. It also provides an incentive for manufacturers to reduce or phase out their use of priority chemicals and to select safer alternative chemicals or an alternate product design. Now, the Pollution Control Agency does support the idea of making the reporting requirements as consistent with other state requirements like the state of Washington. We are in the process of reviewing the DE1 amendment, and if we have any comments about how to further make that more consistent with the state of Washington, we'd be happy to provide that to the author. But overall, to sum up, the Pollution Control Agency supports the reporting requirements. It's consistent with our earlier report, and we really welcome the opportunity to enhance the information that's available to Minnesotans about chemicals in their products so that they can make choices about what they purchase and use.
Right. Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. So any further questions from members? Okay, seeing none, is there anyone else in the audience who wants to testify for or against the bill? Okay, and there was another question.
I think we'll just defer it until the next.
Okay, all right. So, seeing no further questions, I'm going to renew my motion. That where is it here? That House File 605, as amended, be recommended to pass and be referred to the Civil Law Committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. All opposed, no.
No.
The motion prevails, the bill is passed, and we are adjourned.
Thank you, Madam Chair.